I was actually born in Latvia. My parents left with the German army, and okay, so my parents basically left when the Soviets invaded Latvia, and we lived in displaced person camps for about 7 years, and then emigrated to the United States in 1951, because we were sort of sponsored by an aunt. Well, I was 7 years old when, you know, I moved to the small town in Missouri, but I was with my uncle and aunt, so they had children, so my cousins, so we had a sort of protected like 1 year transition. And then we moved to St. Louis. My father got a job, and then we were pretty isolated, pretty good, pretty different, you know, like. This feeling that you're not like the rest of them, you're different from everybody else. But my parents, I think, inculcated in me that it was good to be different, that was actually, you could be proud to be different. They were in the leadership class in Latvia, so they were expecting me to be a leader, so you're supposed to be different, you're supposed to be special. Mm-hmm. And my father was a professor at the University in Riga.
Okay.
So Latvian culture is really dominated by women, so she was a dominant person. If you meet enough Latvian families, you'll see that the women, it's a woman, it's a woman-dominated society. I have a sister, an older sister. She's still in the U.S., but she just bought an apartment in Riga, so now she's commuting between the U.S. and Riga. At the time, you know, in the emigre community, I would say it's just Latvian. Everybody wants to, I think in the Latvia now, I don't think that doesn't seem to be the case anymore. But
I think it's because the educated classes were targeted, so the educated classes that weren't deported fled.
Right.
So there was already that structure to succeed in the immigrant community.
In Amberg, Germany?
First
no, Württemberg. Württemberg, yeah. It's one of the smaller ones near Württemberg. Same part of Germany, probably. But I don't remember being in any scouts or anything. But well, I think it was pretty good as far as I know. I mean, as far as I can remember. I mean, we were fed by the U.S. Army or the UN nation, United Nations, so we had it good. It's the poor Germans that didn't have the food. My father, he was an MD and a professor of medicine in Latvia. But in the U.S., they wouldn't recognize his papers and so on. And so he had the bad luck of his research was in tuberculosis, and at that time, tuberculosis was solved with antibiotics, you know, during the war. So basically, whatever expertise he had was obsolete. So he wound up as a real low level technical, you know, technician sort of job. He had a hobby that sort of, you know, intellectually saved him, as he was an amateur botanist. And so he started working with the Missouri Botanical Garden, which is a very reputable research institute, has a research institute. And so he was actually, you know, especially after he retired, like, you know, he was basically accepted as a professional botanist. So he got his, you know, intellectual brownie points and his, you know, his social sort of acceptance through that. Which is really, he was very, very fortunate that way. No, he had to learn English. They were bad. They had poor language skills. So it wasn't. But he was intelligent. I mean, he learned, but he always, you know, really bad accent, very bad, you know, difficult, a lot of language problems. My parents wouldn't speak English, so I had to speak Latvian to them.
Mm-hmm. And they had a grandma who only talked German to them.
Yeah. And there was a society of about 10 people, you know. 20 people, so it's real. You know, we're talking small numbers. They actually sent me like to summer camp in Canada, to Toronto, where there's a big Latvian community. No, they tried extremely hard to keep us, you know, in the cultural, you know, culture. We came, it was my mother's sister's husband was actually teaching in this small college in the U.S., and so he was our sponsor. So we went, you know, we went there, but we didn't sponsor anybody to follow us. 50s, I mean, at first it was, you know, they were afraid, I mean, I don't think the letters were delivered in any case, but they were afraid to identify themselves as being relatives in the West. I mean, we had a, And my sister, my mother's one sister was staying in Latvia, and she was basically paranoid about, you know, being associated with, you know, the Westerners, because while Stalin was alive, that was considered being traitor. In other words, if you had a relative in the West, then you were considered a traitor, period. I mean, by definition. And that caused, you know, that's why a lot of people got deported and so on, because they had relatives in the West. So the letter writing and so on only started probably in 57, 58 or something like that. And then, yeah, they maintained, you know, letters. It was always a big event, because, you know, you couldn't write too many letters, and you couldn't write too much detail, because they were all, I mean, they were certainly censored or they were read.
But then you learn how to write in code, too.
Yeah.
And write a lot of stuff that would pass and hope that, you know, little secrets wouldn't be noticed.
I mean, whenever the Latvians, I mean, there were 10 or 20 Latvians in St. Louis, whenever they got together, that's the main topic of conversation was the war stories and the flee, you know, the fleeing. I think what was important for them, or it was the actual, you know, process of leaving Latvia or the fleeing Latvia and how they went and what happened and how they had to avoid bombings and how they had, you know, even so-and-so died on the way and so-and-so, you know. So that was always a never-ending, you know, never-ending stories. Land of perfect, you know, perfection, you know. They totally idealized it, you know, saying this is, you know, the best place, the best, you know, everything. Food was the best, everything was the best. Education was the best, weather was the best. Because St. Louis has awful weather, so it's easy to say it's the weather was better, you know.
My parents left Latvia, and they're younger than his parents, so they were actually not even in their 20s when they left Latvia. And they met in Germany in the DP camp in Erlangen, and then they had me, and they then came to the U.S. when I was a year old, and they came with my mother's mother and my father's two parents, and he had a sister who had gone to the U.S. earlier and gone to school in Texas. She went to library school in Texas. And then I grew up outside of New York City in Yonkers, and most weekends most socializing was within the Latvian immigrant community, which was a lot more lively than Carlos's experience in the, you know, middle America. And it was really quite nice. I was an only child, and I spent my days with my grandmother, so I learned Latvian, and I also learned to read and write Latvian really well, which I can still do. And the culture was part of kind of childhood dreamland sort of thing, and that's really stayed with me, and that's the nice part about it all. My parents had really interesting friends. My father had friends that he, his lifelong friends have been people that he went to high school with in Latvia. You know, his communication got better, and then, you know, contacts were just reinforced. And my parents were quite young. My father had, in Germany, he had a pretty good education, and so he spoke English well. He spoke German after living there, and he worked at lousy jobs. Like, he worked in a eyeglass factory, he worked in a carpet factory, and he went at night to school at CCNY, so he was like, all night was taken up, and there was hardly any money, and we lived outside of Manhattan. We lived in Yonkers, so like, he'd have these really big commutes. And then after he finished all that up, he became a librarian at New York Public Library. And my mother, she was going to be a dentist in Latvia, but her education was interrupted, of course, by the war, and she never picked up anything after she came to the States. But she ended up working. She had a job in a food testing laboratory somewhere in Brooklyn, so she'd go and like work with animals all day, and like, you know, when there was take the kid to work day, I could get to go and like play with the mice and the rabbits, and it was great. I loved it. I thought she had the best job in the world. And then she got a job working in, as a lab technician at Columbia Presbyterian. And, it was hard. She had to go to work every day, and the subway ride probably was over an hour for both of them in total. And it was a subway and two buses to, come home. So it was like, sleep, get up, go to work, come home, eat dinner. So I saw very little of them, actually. And then so my grandmother raised me, and that was, then I got a really good flavor of, like, old Latvia and the way it was, and probably exclusively mm-hmm. made Latvian food. Sauerkraut and that that klingermai is the yellow saffron bread.
Oh, rye bread's good, yeah. But one of the favorites are these little the bacon buns, pidogs, yeah.
When I was 13, we had a big powwow on Easter morning, and everyone had a vote whether to move. My dad was offered a job at in Saratoga Springs at a girls' school. It was a girls' college then, Skidmore College. He was offered a job as a librarian. Mm-hmm. And on Easter morning, the whole family got to vote whether we should move or not. And we all thought it would be exciting to move upstate to this small town, and we'd have our own, we lived in an apartment. We have our own little house, and he always wanted a garden. He'll garden my mother. The move was hard on her because she grew up in Riga. She believed in cities. She was basically a city girl. She started going to the opera when she was very young, and she continued that the whole time that we lived outside of New York City. And she managed to see every performance that Maria Callas ever sang at the Met. And she'd take me to the opera and all that. So that was the one thing that, actually really, the whole war thing was so hard on her, but that really kept her going. And so when they moved upstate, there was less of that. But then we lived in a small town, which turned out to be this wonderful cultural center, because they built a performing arts center with time, and it became the summer home of the Philadelphia Orchestra and the New York City Ballet. So that was kind of really nice. And then we moved to Saratoga, and it was all like really kind and pastoral, but with a lot of a real cultural aspect to it. But then there were like absolutely no Latvians around, and we went from like being in a really having access to a very vibrant Latvian center to like hardly ever seeing Latvians at all, except their friends when they come and visit and stuff like that. Well, but the teachers were good, and it was a really good experience. I also went to summer camp in the Catskills. There's a Latvian camp there, and I absolutely hated it. It was just wild, and because I think there were so many children that came from families that had problems, so the children, they were screwed up too. And if you went to school and you told everybody you were Latvian, it was all, Latvian, what's that? Where's that? Latin? You speak Latin? I mean, I heard that all my life. Not religious. Went to church sometimes on Easter, sometimes before Christmas. And church was basically, socializing with Latvians. I think the God thing just fell away with the war.
Cultural part of her family is that her aunt, who unfortunately passed away at a young age, is a very noted writer in Latin. So.
And a writer in exile, but she wrote in Latvian, and she became well known in the U.S. and eventually became well known in Latvia. And she went back to one of the old Latvian religions, kind of strange
paganism.
And was really interested in that. And then she died. Everyone smoked because they started smoking. My dad didn't, but my mother did. Everyone started smoking in the camps because this was a way to beat hunger.
Mm-hmm.
And it ended up with a lot of early illness. And my aunt died when she was 53 from lung cancer. But just before she died, she converted to Catholicism. Her name was Ilze, I-L-Z-E, and Latvian is Skipsnot. It was Skipsna. I went to Skidmore, which is then was a women's college in upstate New York, where my dad had the job, and then I got free tuition, and I lived at home, so I didn't have to pay for room and board and all that stuff. And then after that, I went to grad school at University of Chicago, and I did a master's in art history, and I met him, and Then we moved to Washington, D.C., where he got a postdoc.
And so I was educated in the United States, finished my graduate degree at the University of Chicago, did some postdoc work in Washington, and then got a academic position here at the University of Alberta in 1974. Yeah, this was in the, right at the Vietnam War time, and there were no academic positions in the U.S., and Edmonton, Alberta was booming because of the oil boom, and so I'm being in geology. It was a very easy thing to do. Mm-hmm. My PhD supervisor is a Canadian, and a lot of the people I worked with in Washington were Canadian, so Canada's very strong in earth science and geology, so Canadian geologists are everywhere, so it's easy, you know, like I'd met Canadian. I mean, it wasn't like I was dropped into a strange place, strange area. So it was very smooth and easy. Because I work with oil and gas, there's I've been here more than 35 years, and my laboratory and work has never suffered for lack of money. Alberta's always been filthy rich, and there's always been opportunity to keep up, and I've done a lot of exciting things. I mean, the obvious moneymaker is oil and gas, and I'm starting to work now with sort of environmental issues, you know, trying to solve problems with leaking oil and gas wells and so, which I find some sort of contributing to society, not just exploiting. In terms of the Latvian stuff, is in the last four years, I started an initiative on studying amber, like scientifically study amber, the origin of amber, and the kinds of things amber can tell you. It was done basically purely because I could, you know. I have Leld has tons of amber, and I was curious about amber, and we just, you know, and there was people in my department that were also interested. I mean, I could get interested in amber studies, so, you know, for me, amber is important, and so why the hell not? Why not analyze amber and study amber instead of coal or instead of trees or something? Well, amber comes from trees, but, well, Baltic amber comes from a tree that no longer exists in that part of the world, but is still alive in Japan. It's called the Japanese umbrella tree.
And nobody knows this. They all think it comes from trees that are there now, like the same trees.
They think it's, yeah. The public thinks that it's the tree you see that created the amber, but it's not true at all. And we've published that, actually, in a reputable journal, so we're all happy about it. And then I work with other people on, like, inclusions in amber, like insect inclusions in amber, and try to understand, not so much as an entomologist, we try to identify insects, but to understand if the amber records some kind of ecological signal. And part of that actually grew into a little study on mountain pine beetles. Mountain pine beetles, when they attack pine trees, they actually kill the tree. But the tree usually produces a lot of sap and so on, which could be a potential future amber. Well, at first we were really excited because we were getting away from the big city, you know, going to a small town. We thought we'd be in the mountains like Banff and Jasper. So it was really exciting. We called everyone. The first day was minus 20 Fahrenheit. You know, we called all our friends in the south and said, hey, it's minus 20. Ran around outside to see what it felt like. So it was really quite exciting, quite thrilling. I think novelty wore off. Yeah.
The longer we live here, the less we go outside.
Yeah. We drove, actually.
We did Hale Bay on the way between Saskatoon and Edmonton. We drove from Washington, D.C. in a little Beetle with a dog and all their stuff up to Canada. And we crossed at somewhere in North Dakota.
Yeah, just south of Winnipeg, you know.
Yeah, and there was, you know, we did all the paperwork coming in, and then they were so officially welcoming. It was so cool.
I think it was at night, too. We drove in at night. We crossed the border at night. And mm-hmm. Saying, welcome.
Yeah. Welcome to the Dominion of Canada or something like that.
No, I waited for, I just wanted to be sure professionally and so on. I got the job offer, and then of course I had to, you know, get the visas and so on. But we only came to Canada when I had all the legal papers already, you know, signed, sealed, and so when we crossed the border, we had all the finished papers. And immigration papers, and so that's why they...
I remember before leaving D.C. that summer, it was, we came here in October. Before leaving D.C. that summer, it was extremely hot, as usual, and we would go to the bookstore, and we would look at pictures of the Rockies in Canada. Like, we did that every week.
I hate to confess, I actually got the job offer sort of, you know, before I knew where Banff was, because I thought Banff actually was in the U.S. somewhere. So
one of the things my parents did when they got to the States, because they were still very young, they got, as soon as they could afford it, they bought an old car. And then they were very adventurous and they started traveling around the U.S. So, because they were curious. And when I was 16, we did a trip, all like a big circular trip around the U.S. And we also went into Canada. So I had been, we went as far as Banff. We didn't go up to Jasper. So I'd been there. So I was like really excited to take my husband up to Canada. And I couldn't wait till after we came here till we go to the mountains and everything. But we were so excited to come here. It was cool. I worked in like crummy art jobs until we came here. There was a woman who, I worked at the Corcoran in the gallery shop, and there was a woman, one of those women's committee ladies, who said that somewhere she had recently met the director of the Edmonton Art Gallery, and she said, you know, when you go up there, you can get a job there. So I believed her. You know, I just believed her. So I went up there and I applied, and I went like the first month for an interview at the gallery, and I got the best job anybody could ever, ever hope for. And it was like, I could never get a job like that in the U.S. because it was so competitive. And also art history is a field that there's a lot of, you know, you get jobs through connections and
old
there's
money.
A lot of, yeah. So anyway, I got this job here where the director like just put a lot of trust in his staff and gave you projects that were like you never would think that you could do, but then you did them and you could do them. So I was an extension curator and basically responsible for touring exhibitions in Alberta. Then also did a lot of stuff in the gallery and wrote catalogs. Like, how great is that?
She's talking about the Lougheed years, you know, that was 74 she started. And there was so much optimism and so much money available. Like the Edmonton Art Gallery had money and they had...
And it had
optimism,
taste.
You know, they had this optimism that, you know, things are great, let's take art to the masses. It was just a totally different mindset from now.
Fabulous artists from, well, everyone's from New York and London, England, and Toronto and stuff like that. And some of the artists that they were very close to were some people that I had already met in college, so... It was just this remarkable kind of, you know, come around the circle type of thing. Absolutely marvelous here. We were really excited to come here. What we didn't, as having grown up in America, which is completely oblivious to all things Canadian, we thought, oh, it's just going to be like the U.S. And the longer we've lived here, the less and less it is like the U.S. No, we thought we were just going to be just the same. People would write me and they'd ask me if there were sidewalks here. Speaking of Canadian myths, I have a kid who went to school in California, and he was in a small dorm, but he would tell people that he went to school in a canoe, and they'd believe him.
He's yeah. Across the
street. We had three. They love Canada. They love coming here. They all went to school across the street. And then various schools around town. The first two aunties went to the University of California, San Diego, and that was the time of all the budget cuts, and the U of A had really cut back, and everything, the whole atmosphere here was absolutely terrible. So he went there, and then he went and did medicine at Washington University in Seattle, and he's basically a malaria researcher. He's got an MD, PhD. And has been to Africa, and now he has a daughter. And then his sister was born, well, she was born in October 79. Mm. Yeah. And she just got married this summer in Zurich, and she's an economist, and she's working in Washington, D.C. Went to the U of A for a while. She, through the U of A, she went to Japan for a year, and she actually learned Japanese. Now she works for an environmental think tank in D.C., and her husband's a economist too, from Switzerland. The third kid is Emil's, and he was born in 83, and he has a condo downtown, and he works as an engineer for Enbridge. They're very patriotic. They don't speak Latvian. They did when they were little, but they're extremely patriotic.
Yeah, it's a funny situation for year records and so on, is that when we had our firstborn, we basically raised them pure Latvian. So when we thought we were
raising him bilingual, but since we only talk Latvian to him at home, he got very mixed up.
But anyway, when he went to grade school, he didn't speak English, even though, he was born here. That caused a few problems. And we raised a sister, who's 2 years younger than him, also pure Latvian. But when they both wound up in grade school together, kindergarten and first grade, and they switched to English, and that was the end of,
I'm, like, the colonel is Latvian, the attitude is American, and I don't think I'd like to live in America anymore. I love living here. The climate is really harsh. After a while, you get a lot of pride having survived it.
Because if I said something other than I'm a Latvian, then my mother would turn over in her grave. So I can't say that. A Latvian, yeah, maybe a Latvian Canadian, yeah. Canadian, I don't really, like Lelda, I feel more American than I do feel Canadian, even though I think the modern America is, because we've left America in 74, and it's evolved in its own way. So culturally, we're no longer American.
I remember when I got naturalized and we went to some ceremony when I was little in New York. I remember that because it was really special. And then when we went to get our Canadian citizenship, which we just did recently, that was really special too. And it connected the two things. And I'm really glad we have it. So
the application form for the landed immigrant card was identical to the application for citizenship, but the landed immigrant card you have to renew every 5 years. Citizenship thing is permanent, so.
I think the most difficult things now are how to consider Latvia now, because you have so much baggage from your past, and Latvia has changed so much, and it's so unlike what you were told it would be, and then when you go there, it's like, so many things are wrong, and it's very shocking. And I've been there 4 or 5 times.
Twice in the last 2 years. Lelda went there under the Soviet occupation, so she went there once in 77.
Yeah.
And then she went back. We went back right after freedom in 94. And then we've been back a few times since. But it's not, I always find it extremely stressful, because I know from what my parents told me what I should be doing and so on, and then the reality isn't what they would have thought, and so for me it's difficult to go back. It's partly because of the sort of hidden things my parents drummed into me, and expectations and so on, that that this isn't, you should be, if it's wrong you should fix it, so if you don't like, which of course I haven't done. And
what I find most disturbing is that evil is really palpable, and you don't have that here, really. I mean, you don't even consider evil living here. Only, I think, in very rare circumstances. But it's just an everyday thing there. There are things that shouldn't happen to people, and they happen to people. And
it's corrupt. I mean, Latvia is very corrupt.
It's corrupt, and with corruption comes, there's a level of violence, and with poverty, then there's a different level of violence, and that's the undercurrent there. During the Soviet era, it was like, it was pure shock, and I got there, and I just remember just crying, going to people, crying one night, because just seeing how bad it was, and how people lived, and what their apartments were like, and what little they had. and all that. It was deeply shocking. And also, being around that kind of repressive government, you just learn every day how deceitful they can be in ways that you really don't imagine. Like, there was this movie, The Lives of Others, about East Germany. Did you see? So I said, I don't want to see that. I know all that stuff. I know, but you know, watch the movie. And it's like, no, I don't. You know, they're beyond us in figuring out ways to torture people. And then going back the other times, the first time I went back was maybe about 10 years or more, 15 years, when it had first become free. I don't know, I just had traumatic experiences with the way people drove and the way even your relatives tried to fleece you, and you just didn't really know what the, you didn't know what you're dealing with. You had no idea what their experiences really were. You didn't really know your relatives. And also on that trip, I met a dozen or more people, both in his family and my family, who had been to Siberia, but had also come back. So that doesn't include the ones that, you know, went and never came back. But then you meet these people that had gone through that, and it's like, what do you, there's nothing you can say to them. What do you say to them? But they're just very happy for the contact. And I remember we were there once with the kids asked an aunt of Carlos's, was it hard being in Siberia? And she said, well, not after the first 7 years. There, because you've grown up here, there are just all these things that you can't really get your head around because you don't understand them.
First of all, we took out Latvian citizenship for all three kids, so they all have Latvian passports. When I first came here, I was actually president of one of the local churches, but that was...
Yeah, like, whenever there was something going on, we'd usually go. Yeah. We don't go to everything, but we usually go. Imanta's done a really good job recently, really trying to integrate the new people, but
yeah.
There's been... One of the best things they did was have a reception for the Masters Games. And all these athletes came from Latvia, and he wanted to put on this huge dinner party with Latvian food, and the athletes had brought bread from Latvia, because I don't think Latvians travel without rye bread in their suitcase, and it was a great party. It was really, really neat. And then afterwards, and Imant has helped the people come here so much, just with materials, well, basically setting them up, helping them with legal stuff,
I think just giving him moral support, or, you know, some kind of a... We actually had a big party. I mean, Amont organized it.
No, that was amazing.
Yeah,
that was amazing.
The people that were being oppressed probably thought, I'm being oppressed, but, you know, my culture is being destroyed, but it's being preserved in Toronto. So I think it was so psychologically it was a real, really, really important for the people being under the Soviet thumb to actually realize that there's this, you know, space, freedom space, where the truths could be preserved. And then now that, you know, there's no longer Soviet repression, the cultural role the emigres could have is past. I mean, now the culture has to be in Latvia. I mean, we can tag along, but we're no longer the prime.
I mean, we're preserving something through nostalgia, but now it's alive and well.
Yeah.
And it may not pay that much attention to, you know, the older stuff that was held precious when we came here by our elders. But, I mean, they're poets, they're writers, they're artists, they're musicians. It's like going strong.
Diaspora did play a very important role as like a beacon of hope and so on. And they did actually preserve stuff. They did, you know, and then immediately after the changes, they could, you know, send books and stuff and, you know, encourage the, you know, reestablishment. But if I had given a choice, I'd say, of course I wanted to live in a Latvian ghetto, you know. I would want to have all my neighbors be Latvians, you know, but it's not going to happen. I mean, we're totally out of step with, you know, the Tea Party and stuff like that. Well, again, I mean, from a tourist point of view, it's that Freedom Monument in Riga. For other things, is the Latium Decoder Ring. I mean,
I think the nature, like, if someone says Latvia, I immediately imagine like fields and woods and the seashore, which, you know, I've seen very briefly in my life, but that I think is all from like literature and poetry and what our parents talked about.
there's a little
What's
house
the
in Garno
Garno where the electrical power station is
I tore
now?
it down 110th, which is, yeah,
It's a
now a
really
little
sweet
power
house.
substation,
A really sweet brick house.
tiny little brick bung, you know, 3-room house or whatever. Just
Yeah.
one of those tiny little Edmonton houses. But it got torn
We
down.
moved in here in like
But this is our
78.
second house.